Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Off the Shelf for this rainy in here in Philadelphia, Saturday, March the 13th, 2010. I am your host, Denise Turney, delighted and happy to be with you this morning. I'm the author of the book, Long Walk Up. Please stop in and visit me online at www.chistell.com and pick up a copy of Long Walk Up or one of my other books today. Again, I'm coming to you live from Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. Today, I'm honored to bring A. Morris to you. A. Morris is the author of the books Justin and My Cowboy Hat Still Fits. He began his rodeo career riding junior bulls. We can find out later what that is. For 9 years, he broadcast telecast of the world famous, I hope I'm saying this right, Cheyenne Frontier Days Rodeo, the daddy of them all, with Prime and Fox Sports Network. He is a former member of the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association and the National Intercollegiate Rodeos Association. A. Morris grew up in Woodstown, New Jersey. New Jersey is such a small state, but it has, I think, a billion different towns in it. He's also attended the University of Wyoming on academic and rodeo scholarships. He's a businessman and an author. He has been featured on television and in newspapers around the United States. He's also a father who dedicates his life to loving his son. A. Morris is online at www.amorris.com, and his name is spelled A-B-E-M-O-R-R-I-S. Again, that's www.amorris.com. Please check, stop in, visit him online, and keep up with what he's doing. Welcome to Off the Shelf, Abe.
Thank you, Denise. It's a pleasure to be on this morning. I really appreciate you bringing me on.
I'm so happy. I'm excited. This is the first rodeo person I think I've ever interviewed in my entire life after doing radio for about 6 years. So you are absolutely the first. When I was researching for your interview, I was very impressed by your bio and how much you have done and the different things I came across about you on the internet. You have an impressive life story so far. So kudos to you for going after what you want, because you've done a variety of different things, which we'll touch on during the interview. And just to begin, when I was a little kid, I know my father, he took us to maybe one or two rodeos, and I kind of enjoyed them. After a while, I thought they were kind of, I don't know, I enjoyed being at the rodeo. I love nature, so that part of it that I did enjoy. But to me, bull riding seemed somehow unnatural for the bull. It seemed like fun. Of course, the audience loved it. With that experience so far, I just wanted to, that's about the most experience I have with the rodeo as we go into this interview, so I'll learn a lot. I wouldn't think, Abe, when I was doing this, I'm like, what's town, New Jersey? He's from New Jersey? I'm thinking, they have rodeo in New Jersey. When I read your bio that you started riding young, I'm like, where in the world did he ride bulls in New Jersey? But when I did my research, I learned that Cowtown, New Jersey, is which is in Montgomery Township in Somerset County, which surprised me because I worked at Merrill Lynch and they had offices over there in Somerset. But what I learned was that Cowtown Rodeo started in 1929, for our listeners here this morning, by the Harris family, and it's the longest-running regular rodeo in the United States. And this is sitting right under my nose, and I never even heard of it. So I wanted to ask you, do you know, Abe, or did you work with members of the Harris family when you worked the Cowtown Rodeo?
Okay, I'm just going to make a real quick correction on you. Actually,
okay.
Cowtown is in Salem County.
Oh, okay.
Okay, it's just right across the river, the Delaware River, from you. So, yes, I knew the Harris family very well. Their dad, Howard Harris III, and two sons. Grant Harris is about 3 years older than me, and then another son, Andy Harris, who's actually since deceased, was just a year older than myself. So I went to high school with those guys. I know them very well.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. So what was it about the rodeo aid that drew and kept your attention for so long? I would have to say I have seen other African-Americans involved in the rodeo, and like my dad's involved in loves cars, and we used to go to drag races when I was a kid. I didn't see a lot of African-Americans at the drag races, but there are people of color who are diverse people who are attend those events. But what drew you? It's not something popular you would think a little kid, African-American kid, would dream of growing up and getting involved in a rodeo. What about it caught your attention?
My cousins actually lived right at Cowtown, and Cowtown, the rodeo arena, was only about maybe 150 to 200 yards from their house. And before I ever went to kindergarten, my dad, who was a Baptist minister, sent me out to live with my cousins so they could kind of toughen me up. And they were already involved in rodeo. Their names are Gene Walker, Jimmy Lee Walker, Willie Ed Walker, who actually passed away in November. Actually, excuse me, in October of last year. But my older cousins were involved in the sport. And then, you know, they, like I said, they kind of brought me under their wing. And like when I was, before I ever started kindergarten, I was out there hanging out with them, and that's what got my interest, because they were started in rodeo, and they were riding ponies and horses and things of that nature, and that's how I got started, because of my cousin's coaching.
Okay, what are the junior bulls? Are they like the baby, or the junior, what are those, the baby, or not babies, but they're not fully grown? Is that what the difference in those, what you started out riding?
That's exactly correct. They are actually, you know, they're calves when they're born, and then they become junior bulls, which are about two-year-old bulls. And then after you get a little older, then they become the full-grown, the big bulls. But it was a nice little setup, because what happened was the stock contractor could bring in the bulls that he thought had potential and buck those. And if they bucked really well, he would keep them. And with us, it was, you know, the kids, we could get on and figure out whether or not we really wanted to continue with the sport. So it was a win-win for both. If the bulls didn't buck, sad but true, he got rid of them. And you know, it was like, because you couldn't afford to feed something that wasn't going to produce for you. So that's what
right.
happened with the junior bulls.
Okay, okay. When did you go from riding bulls to broadcasting rodeo events? How long were you riding? And I know, and if you could just talk about some of your achievements, I know you did win awards and things, but when did you go from riding bulls? How long did you do that? And then when did you start broadcasting the rodeo events?
Well, actually, I went to the University of Wyoming, and I got my degree in business. And after I graduated, I was in Laramie, Wyoming, and there was a weekly PRCA, which is the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association rodeo right there in Laramie. And one night the announcer actually wasn't there and couldn't do the rodeo, so somebody asked me to announce the rodeo, and I announced the rodeo, and then I kept announcing it every single week after that, and then I got my announcer's card. I was already a member of the PRCA, and then eventually, it was kind of a long story, but I went to Cheyenne. It's actually Cheyenne Frontier Days. It's in Wyoming 1 year, and a camera crew interviewed me, and later on, the next year, they came back, and it was called Prime Sports Network at the time, which was later became Fox Sports. But they, you know, they asked me to announce the rodeo. They were going to film the finals, and asked me if I would be interested in being the broadcast commentator. So that I started, and that went on for the next 9 years as a broadcaster.
Wow.
At the world famous Cheyenne Frontier Days Rodeo.
I'm always fascinated when I hear people tell stories, and I've heard people who've gone on to do very well in different fields talk about how they either transitioned or got started, and it sounds like either somebody didn't show up or it wasn't anything that was planned. It was something that just seemed to happen out of the blue, and the person, you know, when opportunity knocks like you did, you say yes. A lot of people might talk themselves out of it by being afraid and saying I won't do a good job or whatever, and they say no, but look what it turned into for you. I think that is just amazing. So I was going to ask you how you got started in broadcasting, and now we see somebody was supposed to be there announcing the show, and they weren't there, and they asked you to do it, and you saw that opportunity, and you said yes, and just walked right into it. Can you share with us, our listeners here at Off the Shelf, before we go into some of your, a little bit more about your broadcasting than your books, if you could just tell us a little bit about one or two of your events that you did as a rodeo broadcaster that will stick with you forever?
Well, without a doubt. 1989 in July was the first year that I actually did the broadcasting, and so we were all pretty much new at it. And before the rodeo, the broadcasting crew asked me to interview several cowboys because in case we needed some extra footage of interviews, et cetera. And I just picked out guys. They already knew who I was, so it was just easy. I just approached them, hey, I'm doing the show, da-da-da-da, and I would like to interview you before the rodeo. Well, one of the people that I interviewed was a 1987 world champion bull rider by the name of Lane Frost. And I interviewed about probably 15 guys before the rodeo, and we were on camera, and so I shook everyone's hand, said good luck. Well, when I interviewed Lane, I shook his hand, I said good luck, but, you know, in retrospect, looking back, I have to say that I honestly said goodbye because Lane Frost got killed that day.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Yeah, it was tough. It was July 30th, 1989. That's, you know, those are things that you never forget. You know, I was a grown man, et cetera, but I broke down and cried just like a little baby. It really tore me up. I was still competing at the time, and, you know, after that, the very next rodeo I went to was about 3 days later, and I didn't necessarily have a bad bull drawn, but just because a friend of mine had died a few days before at a rodeo, and I had talked to him, I saw the whole thing happen, too. I was right there. It tore me up. I was scared to death to get on another bull at that time.
Oh, yeah, I can only imagine. That is, and on a lot of sports, like I was talking about, drag racing, they're dangerous sports, but more than often than not, people don't get, you know, they don't have that type of a end in when they're involved in a sport, but it does happen. I want to talk about your books next, Abe. When did you write My Cowboy Hat Still Fits? And what if you could just tell us a little bit about the book, some of the situations or experiences that you cover in your book, My Cowboy Hat Still Fits.
Okay. Well, you know, of course, the Lane Frost story is there from Cheyenne Frontier Days, but I had some coworkers. I worked in financial services and got to be pretty good friends with my coworkers, and they actually told me, you know, you have a really unique background, you know, an African-American coming from New Jersey, which is pretty much unheard of, and becoming an announcer, a broadcast person on television, et cetera. And they said, you need to sit down and write your story because you're a very unique individual. So I had one coworker who sat right next to me, and she bugged me and bugged me and bugged me for about probably 10 months. She loved to read, and she said, you need to write your book. So I finally got tired of her bugging me. That's the only reason I actually started the book. And I give her credit, too. I'll tell you her name. Her name was Trisha Cog, but she was persistent, and she bugged me and bugged me and bugged me. And finally, like I said, okay, I'll start. So I started one day, and that was the only incentive I needed. Once I started, it took me about 10 months to actually write the book. I wrote the book. I proofread the manuscript, on and on. So, and I put, you know, a lot of stories in there. I tried as best as I could to remember the goods and the bads and the things that stick out, which are easy. You know, you can remember the times you got hurt. You can remember the times you won first place at certain rodeos when you won buckles. And I just went back and just, you know, relied on my memory and wrote the book. And so it took me about 10 months to write the book. After I finished the manuscript, it took me about another year and a half to actually find a publisher who would agree to publish it. So I didn't give up. I told them.
That, not to cut you off, but that is interesting. You have such an interesting story. And from talking to you so far, it sounds like earlier in your career, before this coworker encouraged you to write a book, it sounds like you perhaps might have, and correct me if I'm wrong, thought that what you were doing was common, that there was nothing unusual about you being involved in the rodeo and being an announcer and whatnot. I think it's not common, but it sounds like to you thought it was. Maybe because your cousins lived right across from the rodeo, and from the time you were a little boy, you were just used to that to it. So to you, it was no big deal. But I would imagine that a publisher would snatch up a manuscript like yours, just snatch it up. So I'm surprised to hear you say that.
Well, that's what I thought, too. You know, I'm thinking this is such a unique story. It's inspirational. It talks about, you know, being a minority. And, even then, and I don't even know the statistics or the percentages, but I would say probably 98% of the people that participate in rodeo are white people.
Yeah,
there's only a few minorities
right.
in the whole sport, you know, nationwide. Right. And I thought so, too. Even, you know, one of my things thinking at the same time, I thought maybe – because there were people, when I was writing the book, that said, oh, man, they're going to make a movie out of this. And I was like, oh, I was so excited. But then when I started going after all these literary agents, and they would say, looks good, sounds good, but not for me, I got discouraged. But I didn't give up. I told myself that if it wasn't published within, you know, I gave myself a time frame. And I said, if I can't find a publisher, then I'll self-publish it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to self-publish it, but like I said, a year and a half later, I've actually found somebody that agreed to publish my book. And the person was Annette Sade. She's out of Grable, Wyoming, and the name of her company is Pronghorn Press.
Okay. Wyoming. Back to Wyoming. Man, that state's come up twice so far. Had you ever written anything before you wrote My Cowboy Hat Still Fits? Was this your first time writing either? Had you written any articles before or any other books, or was this just totally a totally new experience for you?
Totally new experience. The only thing I'd ever written before that were book reports and term papers in college, and that was because they were required. So when I sat down and started writing, and then I would hand them off to coworkers and friends and let them proofread what I'd written, people were just amazed. They'd look at me and say, "Were you a journalism major?" And I said, "No." They said, "Man, you write really well." And it just fueled me. It gave me some incentive to keep going, to finish the manuscript, because, you know, that's what it made me feel. And I'll tell you a really quick story too. I went to a rodeo once, and people always were talking about how they're doing this or they're doing this or whatever. And I wanted to prove that I was writing the book, so I took my manuscript to a rodeo and handed it to a friend, and we sat in the grandstands. He started reading the manuscript, and I didn't know what he was reading. I had no idea what he's reading, but he started punching me in my shoulder, and he was crying. He actually had tears rolling down his cheeks. And
my goodness.
Yeah, I said, "What are you reading?" He said, "You got me sitting up here in the grandstands crying, reading your book." He was actually reading the story of when Lane Frost got killed, and he started crying.
Wow. And that is a sign of good writing. When you can, I think good writing, good music, good art, anything, you want to evoke emotion out of people. I think it helps people to get through experiences, helps people to heal. Just whenever you, whatever you create can help pull emotion up out of people. That's, to me, a mark of a good writer. I wanted to ask you, so what was the process? Like you said, it took you 10 months to write the books. You never have written anything before. You've got this coworker saying to you, Abe, you've got this fascinating story. You should write about it. You should tell your story and share it with others. What was it like? Did you start with an outline? I mean, for somebody who's never written a book before and never even thought about writing a book, it would be one thing if you never wrote a book, but you had thought about it and studied about writing books and went to writing conferences and seminars and learned how to do it, then wrote the book. But you completely out of the blue, it sounds like, without any prior training in regards to book writing, sat down and wrote this book. Did you start with an outline for our listeners here at Off the Shelf, who themselves, just listening to you, might think, you know what, I'd like to write a book about such and such experiences that I had? Did you start with an outline, Abe? How did you go about sitting down, somebody who's never wrote a book, looking at a blank page and just getting started?
Actually, I have a really good memory, and that's something people have always known about me. I can remember stories from when I was 3 years old, when I was just a kid, and I lived in Florida. So I just basically just decided to start chronologically. I just wanted to keep it all rodeo, so I just started out with, this is how I actually got started, the first time I got on a bull, and I just tried to just relate back to my whole entire rodeo career. So I did it entirely on memory. I just went from when I started to when I actually ended and went from there. Now, and I'll throw this in too. This is just a little sad point, but at the time when I was competing, I had books. They were kind of like a, you know, I don't know, it would say like a diary, but you know, you kept track of all the rodeos that you entered,
the
bulls you got on, all the money you won, et cetera, et cetera. And I kept really good notes because most of the time when I travel with people, I was the one who did all the entering. As far as the rodeos, I'd write down my scores, my checks. I had everything written down in all these books that I had from my rodeo career. They were very, very precious to me. But here's the sad thing. When I was writing my book, my ex-wife had taken every single one of my rodeo entry books and thrown them into the garbage. I had to write my book from memory, and I had to apologize at the end of my book that I wasn't more detailed, but I said, sorry, you know, would have been into more documentation about my books and the bulls, et cetera. My ex-wife threw my books in the garbage, and that was the best I could do.
Wow. So does everybody keep those books, or is that just something you just did so you'd make sure, you know, the records you said, how you rode, what monies you were due? Is that something required, or did you just do that on your own?
You had to, because you had to treat it like a business. I mean, you enter too many different rodeos and et cetera, and there's no way to remember when you have to compete at all these rodeos, because basically you're free as a bird. You go all over the United States. And you had to keep track of what rodeo you were in because of all the different, you know, time zones and where the rodeo was located, what time the rodeo started. You had to, you know, the distance, driving and all that. So, plus mileage and gas receipts and meal receipts. You had to keep track of what you were doing. And that's the only way to be successful in the sport is keep track of your, you know, your documentation and your records.
Oh, I think that's smart. I gotta tell you, in that type of a business, also to make sure that you're getting paid the money that you're due, and to keep up with how you're performing and what might be causing your performance to fall off or to improve. I think that's smart. I've heard some writers say, Abe, that writing nonfiction, either nonfiction about something they witnessed or nonfiction about like a memoir or autobiography about their own life experiences can be tough. And nonfiction actually sells better than fiction does, but I'm told that writing it can be tough because people start out, they think, this is going to be easy, and it could depend on the subject matter. I know rodeo for you was a very enjoyable experience, I'm assuming that, but sometimes people start out, they think, this is going to be easy. I'm going to write a story about my life. And then they get to something that dredges up a lot of hard emotion, and they're like, whoa. And it's tough to get through it. And they wonder, should I share this? Should I not share this? You know, I really think when people tell their life stories, they're just like really opening themselves up. Would you say for you, I know you said you did a lot of it from memory, but would you say for you that there were parts of it that you wrote about your experiences in the rodeo or things that were going on in your life while you were in the rodeo that you thought, this really is tough for me to deal with? Would you say it was easy the whole way through, or did you have some parts that were a bit challenging?
It was a bit challenging to do the book, but I think, and I'll be honest and let everybody know out there too, at the time I was writing my book, I was separated from my ex, and we'll get into that later, but I was separated from her, I was separated from my son. And what it turned out to be was it was great therapy because I was going through a lot of trauma, dealing with my ex, dealing with the court system, which I would like to talk about later, and on and on and on. And so it basically helped me to get through that stage of my life because I could dwell on the positives that I'd accomplished in my rodeo career and not think about the divorce and not being able to see my son and the things like that I was dealing with. So it really helped me to get through that tough time. So I would say, yeah, there were some things I left out, like people that did me wrong in my first book, well, in both books. I left their names out of them. The people that basically treated me well, I went ahead and told. But there were times, even in the rodeo, where, you know, there were judges, being an African-American coming out west, being kind of like, you know, for lack of a better term, like a fly in a milk bowl. The judges were a lot of old school guys, and it's different now, but there was no doubt in my mind I would make some good rides, and there were times I'd make decent rides or good rides and get off and think, man, I'm going to win first or second or somewhere in there, and then they'd announce the score, and the crowd, I mean, they had been around rodeos all their life, they would actually start booing the judges. It was pretty apparent that they they weren't kind to me on a lot of times, but, you know, it affected me because it affected my bottom line financially on how long I was going to be able to keep going with rodeo. I didn't let those things linger, but, you know, when they went well, you remember those things, but when the judges treated you bad, those things stick in your mind. I don't let them bother me now, but back then I did.
Yeah, I think yeah, it sounds like you tried to stay positive in the book. You know, we all can be negative. So it sounds like you tried to. We all have experiences that we wish hadn't happened to us. But rather than, I guess, you wanted to keep it, it sounds like, on more of a positive tone, because you did accomplish a lot. You did achieve a lot in the rodeo despite some of the obstacles, should we say, that were in your way. I have people who don't know anything about the rodeo. I'm sure there are a lot of people. Have they come to appreciate the rodeo and enjoy My Cowboy Hat Still Fits? Have you had readers come up to you who said, you know, I didn't even know anything about the rodeo, but I really loved your book?
Oh, yes. I've done well as far as the sales on the book. I've actually had 5 people tell me, either through an email or personally, that they read my book from cover to cover in one day. So they started in the morning, and that night before they went to bed, they were finished. They said it was an excellent book that they couldn't put it down, obviously. That was the first book, and I've also had 2 women that have read my second book, Justin, A Father's Fight for His Son, that have told me the exact same thing. So they got up on a Sunday morning, decided they wanted to start reading my book. Before they went to bed that night, they were finished. They said they could not put the book down. So I've had excellent feedback on both books, and my goal is to write at least 3 more books before I decide to check out of this world.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Just a few more questions on the rodeo before we go into Justin and some of your other writings. Have you stayed close to the sport, or you kind of sort of removed yourself from it now that you're no longer writing and broadcasting in rodeo?
I stay close. Anytime I have what I call a radius, and if the rodeos are close enough, I'll usually go watch them because I'm a fan. I'm a bull riding fan. I always will be. I'm still a member of the PRCA. I like to go to some of the other rodeos, like the PBR, which is the Professional Bull Riders. So, and if they're close, I still go. And I also am a freelance writer, and I write for a newspaper. It's called Humps and Horns Bull Riding News, and it's actually located in Choteau, Oklahoma. But I have a column in that newspaper. I've been writing for that paper now for 7 years. So I do have a incentive to go to rodeos. I love to go. I love to go to watch. And, of course, that's where my fans are that'll buy my book. So I go to rodeos. I always have a backpack, and I always had my first book, My Cowboy Hat Still Fits. But now when I go to rodeos, I carry both books, and I'm always trying to sell them. So I have a reason to go to rodeos for, you know, because I'm still a fan, and plus I'm trying to market my book. So it's a win-win for me.
Yeah, you a smart guy, man. You got your audience right there in front of you, and they know you. So you a smart marketer and a smart businessman. Last question on the rodeo, Abe. Who are some of your favorite riders, and what is it about those people that you admired most?
Well, I wouldn't really even break it down to certain people that I follow. I'm a person that I love to read nonfiction motivational books, and I love sports. So, you know, if I pick up a book that talks about someone else's life, and we've all had obstacles, and we all have troubles, and et cetera. So, but they have overcome those things. Those are the ones. I mean, I like to read fiction, you know, nonfiction books about, say, some of the Olympic heroes or some of the sports figures that have done very well, and those are the type of books that I like to read. I've read a book, I read a book about David Thompson. I thought that was a great book, and there's some other books that I've read that I really enjoyed, the sports people that have, you know, done that. So that's one thing that I like nonfiction. That's why the books I'm going to write in the future are also going to be nonfiction books. That's what intrigues me, and I hope that's what intrigues some of the readers of the material that I've written.
Okay, we're going to go and begin to talk about Abe's other book, but before we do, I want to let our listeners here at Off the Shelf who might have just joined us this morning know that we are speaking with Abe Morris. Abe Morris is the author of the books Justin and My Cowboy Hat Still Fits. He worked for 9 years in broadcast television. He works with Prime and Fox Sports. Fox Sports, and I might be saying it incorrectly. He's a member of the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association and the National Intercollegiate, a former member of the National Intercollegiate Rodeo Association. He was born in Woodstown, New Jersey, and got one of his early starts at the rodeo in Cowtown, which is the longest-running regular rodeo in the United States. It started in 1929. Abe is a businessman. He is a graduate of the University of Wyoming, where he attended on academic and rodeo scholarships. And he has been featured in television and newspapers around the United States. And he's also a freelance writer, as he just told us. He's been writing for a newspaper for 7 years with the subject matter being rodeo. He is online at abemorris.com. Please stop in and visit him. Bookmark his website so you can keep up with what he's doing. Again, abemorris.com. I think he has a unique and an uncommon life story, in African-American man involved in a rodeo, and my family has gone to the rodeo just a few times. And also been involved in drag racing, so I know what it's like to be in a sport and not see that many people of diverse culture around you. And yet still, Abe moved forward. He kept moving forward and achieved his dreams and his goals. And thanks to a coworker, he sat down and wrote his story about his experience in the rodeo, which became My Cowboy Hat Still Fits. He said it took him a year and a half to find a publisher. For our listeners here at Off the Shelf, who are writers or dreaming of having their book published, Abe stuck with it, even though he has this unique story that I would think a publisher would just snatch up. He stuck with it until he did find a publisher after a year and a half. So be encouraged as you listen to Abe as we go into the second part of his feature interview. Be encouraged. He stuck with it. He stuck with it in the rodeo. He stuck with it as far as landing a publisher. I want to talk next, Abe, about your book, Justin. If you could just tell our listeners here at Off the Shelf what Justin is about and let them know, I know, but if you could just let our listeners know, is it fiction or nonfiction? And just give us some background on the story.
It's a nonfiction story. It's a very, very sad but true story. And what it is, Justin is my son. And like when I was actually going through and writing my first book, I said I was going through a really tough divorce and visitation, et cetera, with my son Justin. And people, coworkers, they knew the story as well, and my publisher, et cetera, they said, you need to write this second book because this is an unbelievable story. And what Justin talks about is after I was separated from my ex-wife, she did everything that she could think of to keep me away from my own biological son. And the sad thing about it, I mean, she would violate court orders. She would do whatever she wanted. I would write letters to the judge. Look, you know, she violated another one of my visitations. They did they did absolutely nothing to her. And it's a sad story. I don't think any father, African American, white, it doesn't matter, any minority parent, mother, father, son, you know, should not have to deal with what Justin and I had to deal with. And I say even a father or a son or, you know, father or another child. No way the court system should allow another parent to treat the other parent that way. And that's why I wrote the book. It is sad that they allowed her to break court orders, violations, et cetera. I mean, it's a whole stack of them. And got away with it. No consequences at all from the court system.
Well, I think that a lot of the laws in regards to divorce and child care laws go back to, I mean, I think some of them might be coming a little bit outdated and they might need to be reformed or changed, because I think they were times when women didn't work and they had no way to earn a livelihood because companies didn't hire women years ago until they started hiring women more right around World War II. But I think some of those laws might be becoming a little bit outdated, but to just be allowed to break a law and not have anything happen is one thing. I knew a guy I had dated once, he said this woman had gone, took this guy to court so many times, and it's not funny. She had taken this guy to court so many times over child support over little frivolous things that the judge told her, if I see you back in here again, I'm going to put charges on you. Stop it. And then she stopped dragging him in and out of court. It's not gender, male or female, that causes people to do things. I think it's just maybe a glitch in somebody's character. I don't know what causes people to do this. But nobody owns, like, their child. I think they're like gifts to us. And I think it is wrong to keep a child from a parent who is not hurting them and a parent who obviously is loving and caring for the child. The child's going to pay the price for that. It's not going to be so much the other person, the other parent. The child is probably going to be the one to pay a price for that. I think the child should decide who they want to be with. When they're young, I think they want to and need both of their parents. What advice, after what you went through, Abe, and a lot of people might listen, they think that this only happens to women, but it's not true. This also happens to men. I know my father raised all five of us by himself after my mom passed. And then he got remarried and my stepmother left, so he had another child to raise on his own. So I know both sides of that story, although my father didn't go through what you did. But what advice would you give to parents who might not, let's say they're getting a divorce or they're getting separated and there are one or more children involved, what advice would you give to them if they're struggling, somebody's struggling to not use the kids to try to hurt the other person? What advice would you give to the parents so that we can either minimize or just totally eliminate this from happening when people's relationships, they decide to not continue them and the children involved?
I don't know. I guess I would just say scrutinize your potential mate very well. I mean, but there's you can't foresee a lot of things that happen. You know, there's no way I could have foresaw some of these things. I got married, and I was in it for the life, you know, like everybody else, you know, till death do us part. But it didn't happen that way. I really don't know if I have any advice. I'm not an expert. All I can do is just talk about with my book what some of the personal things that happened to me. And there's some things I would like the listeners to know. I think, you know, some of the things were just so mind-boggling that people told me, you need to write this book. And
well, tell us about a few of those things then, Abe. Tell our listeners
I could talk about the book for the next 3 or 4 hours, but I'll tell you some of the things. When I separated from my ex and the judge actually decided how much I was going to pay for child support, and you could go back to the transcripts because I have such a great memory, but she told me she set the child support at that time at $285 a week, $285, and I asked her, why so high? And so she basically told me that she had figured it out two ways. One way was $285, and the other one was about $320 a week or so. It was more than $300. Mm-hmm. And she told me if I argued about it, that she was going to automatically set it at $300-something right then and there. And then she kind of just glared at me and said, so do you want to argue about it? I mean,
Who said this, the judge or?
Yes, a judge in Union County, New Jersey. I'm not going to say any names. Union County. So, you know, anybody can wants to look at my case, go back to Union County and pull up the files of the court transcripts if they exist anymore. But the sad thing was at one point my child support was raised to $360 a week, $360. And here's another sad thing. My ex-wife at the time was making about $30,000 more than me. And I was paying her $360 a week in child support. A month, it added up to $1,442 is what I was paying her. There's a law out there that says you're not supposed to pay more than 50% of what you bring home for child support. That's a law everywhere. I was bringing home about $870 a month, and I was paying her $1,442 for child support. Right there was a violation. But the court system in New Jersey and Union County has never straightened it out. I have actually overpaid her about $24,000 more than what I was supposed to legally pay her. It gets worse than that. Now, here's the other thing. People talk about deadbeat dads. Well, I want to let the people know I have legal custody of my son, Justin. Okay, my ex-wife, right now, with her salary and her bonuses, makes over $100,000 a year. She was court ordered to pay me child support as of September 1st, 2008. And that's over a year and a half. I have never received one single penny from this woman for child support, and I have custody of my son, Justin. He lives with me in Colorado. Now, you want to talk about deadbeat dads? How about a deadbeat mom? She has no contact with my son, Justin, refuses to call him. If he doesn't call her, there's no contact. Sad situation that still continues.
Yeah, I think... And that sounds similar to something that my father went through. But my father, I guess everybody's different. He decided not to pursue that path. I'm not even sure if he ever asked for child support. But he decided not to pursue that path, and just his focus was his children, and just make sure they're okay. And if the mother reaches out, then let the child reach back. And if not, I don't know why. I can't say why, but he didn't seem bitter about it. His focus was his children. So I'm going to focus on my children. I'm going to make sure they have what they need. If they need their other parent, they will have their other parent. I'm not going to block that in any way. My focus is my children. And he raised all five of us by himself, with that being his primary focus. And I don't think my baby brother's mother, I don't think she ever gave my father one penny, but that was his focus. That was his focus. Just, I want to make sure my children are emotionally, psychologically, physically, in every way, doing as best as they can be doing, and so be it. And that was his goal, and he did a very, very good job, I got to tell you. So as you raise your son, Justin, if he wants to reach out to his mother reach out to him, and you do that in love. I know this coming from me may sound like totally nuts, but again, I'm talking, I guess, from experience of my father having done it with five kids. But you can look back when your son is grown and you have a good relationship with him, and you see how well he's grown up, and you can say, you know, that was the reward. Unfortunately, I think it is nuts that the child support payments that some of the states do set. You got to wonder how do people survive paying some of this child support? How do they afford to? How do they afford to feed themselves after, or even pay their own rent after they get through paying this child support? Some areas they make it very low. Some areas the child support is state by state. Some areas it's very high. Some areas it's very low. I wanted to ask you, Abe, how is your son doing today? And did he, when you were still in the rodeo, if he was born, did he go to the rodeo with you? And on the cover of the book, he looks like he's maybe 6 or 7. Is he still a young boy, or is he a teenager now?
He's 10 years old.
Okay.
He's still a young kid. I'd actually retired by the time I was married. I was retired, and Justin was born several years after I retired. But he would go to rodeos with me, but I was already separated from my, you know, by the time Justin was big enough to go to rodeos with me, I was separated from my ex already. I was divorced, and, well, I actually wasn't divorced. I was separated, and then later on got divorced. But when I would do my visitations, I would take him to rodeos, and he loved them. He still loves them. Justin is doing extremely well. And, you know, I don't even know who's on this call. My ex might be on this phone call listening, as far as I know. But here's the sad thing. She shouldn't have to listen to a radio broadcast to find out how her own son is doing. Justin was accepted into an accelerated school, so he'll be in sixth grade next year. He's going to go to an accelerated school and do work, you know, a few years ahead of what he's doing. But, you know, his mom should not have to find that out from a radio broadcast. She should know. She should be a part of his life. Justin is probably the most talented athlete I've ever seen in my life. He plays football, baseball, basketball. He played baseball last year for the first time. He made the All-Star team. He pitched in the All-Star game. He plays basketball. He's by far the best player on the team. I'll give you an example. In one game, the team scored 28 points. Justin scored 14, half of the points. And he did that 2 weeks in a row, scored 14 points. So, and in football, he played football last year for a team called Centaurs here in Aurora, Colorado. And first time Justin touched the ball all year was an interception. He ran it all the way back for a touchdown. So,
congratulations to Justin.
Yeah, he's a great kid.
Yeah,
he's a great kid. He's polite. He's kind. He's very caring. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better son. I think, you know, I want God bless the both of us, you know, his mom and me, to have a child as good as Justin. But
wow.
He should not have had to deal with the separation and all those things. And his mom had, like I said, no contact with her own child. I mean, that's affecting him emotionally. He shouldn't have to go through that. But he is. But we make the best of it. God bless me with actually getting the court system to finally lean in my direction after going through the stuff. And here's another thing. A lot of people know about the David Sean Goldman Brazilian international custody case because he's a New Jersey father. And what I want to say is the state of New Jersey has no right to look at Brazil and complain about how they treat fathers when I was a New Jersey father, a New Jersey case, and they treated me as bad or worse than any father out there. So, you know, when you have people in your own jurisdiction and you treat them like the New Jersey system treated me, you can't point your fingers at somebody else. But my story is the same way. I mean, like I said, I didn't see my son for a whole year because my ex violated court orders. And during that time frame, I live in Colorado, but they were back east. One time, I paid for his airline ticket. I'm driving to the airport to pick him up. I took vacation from work, and my attorney calls on my cell phone. She goes, your wife didn't put Justin on the phone. On the airplane. You're kidding me. I talked to Justin like 3 days before that, and he's, you know, everything was a go. I'm driving, and here's the other thing. She didn't even have the human decency to call me and said, Justin's not on the plane. So I was going to go to the airport and run around like a chicken with my head chopped off. I didn't see my son, like I said, for an entire year, wrote the judge a letter, violated another one of my court orders. He probably just yawned because he never even responded to my letter.
Wow.
No consequences. No consequences again.
Hopefully there are people listening who, you know, at the start of relationships, everybody is just so in love. And then as things slowly might start to fall apart, hopefully there are people listening and then they think about the children and decide that they either, if they would be tempted to do what happened to you, that they wouldn't do it. And if it does happen to them, that they keep the child in mind. It's bad enough that a child doesn't have both parents in their life, but also to not, and I know women who have done this, try to not speak negatively about the other parent because that is their child. That is the child's parent. Even if there's anger, that still is that child's parent. It can be tough not to do that, but to really keep that child as the primary focus. What is best for the child? And I commend you on what you have done in caring for your son, but I just think that's so important. What's best for the child, especially when relationships fall apart badly, to keep the children as the primary focus. What's gonna hurt or help my child emotionally and psychologically in the future? Where can readers learn more about your books, My Cowboy Hat Still Fits and Justin, and where can they pick up a copy of both of your books? Abe, if you could let us know that.
Okay. Well, I actually have a website. It's abemorris.com. You can go on and buy either book, or you can go online and go to Amazon or anything like that and purchase the book. And what I also want people, and I hope they do, I hope, sure, sooner or later it becomes a movie. I hope I get on a talk show because I want to inspire some other parents out there to say, look at what I went through, but yet I ended up getting custody of my son. And I think that's a lot of times people don't want to fight for their kids. They give up because the court systems are jaded against the fathers. But, you know, I wanted to go buy the books. I have a whole backlog of attorney's fees and airline tickets and all that because I was flying back and forth to have court cases in New Jersey, flying back and forth to go to court cases in North Carolina before I finally got my son. And another thing that I want to talk about just quickly, the child support, you know, my child support is in New Jersey. And then my ex took off and went to a different state. Well, here's the sad thing. My situation is so convoluted that the state of New Jersey continues to add arrears to my so-called child support. And even when I said I overpaid my ex about $24,000, she still claims I owe her child support. That's just mind-boggling. You know,
yeah.
When you make $100,000 a year and you won't even give your own son a penny, it's not giving the money to me. You're supporting our child. She hasn't given me a thing, even though it's been court ordered for over a year and a half. Well, the New Jersey court system adds arrears to my child support every single week currently. I've notified them that I was in the North Carolina court system now where she lives. I've been granted primary custody of my son. I wrote a certified letter. I sent it to New Jersey. I said, look, this is the court case. This is the docket numbers. Go and stop this stuff and stop intercepting my tax refunds, et cetera. They still continue to say I owe her money for child support, and it continues every week, even though Justin's lived with me for a year and a half. Unbelievable story.
Wow, that is. Maybe it's time for you to go a level up higher till you get some results. You know, but maybe going back and forth to the same people is not going to get you the results. Maybe you need to just go a step above until you get, you know, get the results that it is that you're looking for. Wow.
I need to go on Dr. Phil or Oprah or somebody so they can go help this man get his case straightened out. You know, I mean, letters don't seem to do any good. I mean, here's the thing. This is sad. New Jersey sent me a thing and said, this is the arrears that you owe. I said, how can I owe this when I have custody from Justin? There's a number listed on the letter. This is sad. I called the number, and the number was disconnected. So how do you straighten that out? So
yeah.
I need to get some politicians involved in my story or some talk show hosts, and we'll get it straightened out.
Yeah. You sound like somebody who doesn't quit, so eventually it will iron itself out. And I'm glad to hear that Justin is doing well and that he continues to move forward. I'm just sitting here thinking about when I was 10 years old. I want to talk a little bit about, and you have an amazing story. You said you're going to write three other nonfiction books. I want to talk a little bit about how you market your books. Both particularly Justin is a very, I'm sure, emotional story with experiences that nobody should have to go through. I wanted to ask you, but how do you market your books? I know you're also a businessman and you're a former member of the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association, the National Intercollegiate Rodeo Association. Do you network? How do you get the word out about your stories? Even if you want to get more information out about Justin, that book. How do you go about spreading the news about your books so that other people become aware of these life experiences that you've had?
Well, I mean, I'm involved in financial services. I'm also a motivational speaker. So anybody out there that would like to have me come talk to them, I can talk about rodeo. I can talk about my book, Justin. I would love for people to contact me and say, I'd like to have you come speak to my group. I can talk about business. I can talk about rodeo, sports. So motivational speaking, I write for Humps and Horns Bull Riding News. I talk about my books in there. I've advertised. I'm on Facebook. I have my website, abemorris.com. So I'm always looking to network and tell people and tell others about my book and my stories and my life. And those are some of the ways that I don't have an agent. I actually wish I had an agent who actually was on board with me, but I don't have an agent to help me market my books. I've done pretty well. I've received a lot of media coverage. I mean, even like this broadcast should help my book sales go up. I was on the front page of the Denver Post.
Okay.
In January, yes, I've received a lot of attention for myself just going out there. But, you know, something I want to really build up is my financial services career, you know, selling life insurance and retirement plans and annuity products that, you know, I can reach out to people that way. My motivational speaking career, I hope that takes off. I want to be like Les Brown one of these days, somebody that goes out and talks to large corporations, because I can get on stage and I have no problem talking. So that's another way. But I know, I hope some, and maybe even a talk show host. I hope someone out there listens to my story and says, you know, we need to get this man on national TV and his son, Justin. I hope so. I really do. But we're going to make it. I know despite the things the court system has done to us, I tell Justin we're going to be positive. And he even wants me to get married again one of these days. So, you know, if his mother doesn't want to be a part of his life, then I guess it's up to me to get a stepmother. So there's a lot of things, but I look through prayer. You know, my dad was a Baptist minister, and my mom, she really motivated me and coached me. And I know my mom, Christine Morris, is on this call, so listening. But I've had a lot of support from family and friends, and that's what kept both of us going. And the goal, I wanted to get my son, no matter what my ex did, no matter what the court system did. I wasn't going to give up. That's the only biological child that I'm responsible for having in this world. And we are together now, and we're going to make it.
Okay. I like that. See, motivational speaker, and you obviously are walking the talk. You obviously also motivate yourself. So very, very encouraging. I can hear that motivational speaker coming out of you as you were talking about being positive and how you're going to make it. And absolutely you will. You've made it through all your other life experiences and challenges so far. So, yeah, you will, and you'll be just fine. I wanted to ask you, as far as the marketing, as we only have about 5 minutes left on the show, what would you say is more beneficial has been for you and for our off-the-shelf listeners who are looking for ways to market their books? Is it the face-to-face, like when you go to the rodeos, would you say the face-to-face events or more of the internet marketing like Facebook and Twitter and having your website and so on? What's been most beneficial for you as far as spreading the word about your books and getting book sales?
Probably, I really can't really say for sure, but I do go onto the internet sites. I'm a member of a couple different sites. Black Authors Connect, that's how I end up meeting you. Facebook, I just joined Facebook in November. But, you know, when I write some of my stories, I tell my readers that about, you know, the stories that I've written, the book that I've written. And I wrote for Humps and Horns about 3 years before my book was ever published. So the nice thing was I had people actually out there who knew about my book that said, I really enjoy your column stories, and when that book comes out, I want a copy. And I had a couple articles in some different papers before the book was published. So the nice thing that was really exciting to me, my book got published. I had ordered the books. I didn't even have copies of the books. And I had checks waiting for me. I mean, I had checks in my hand.
Wow.
People wanted my first book, that My Cowboy Hat Still Fits. I didn't even want their money because I didn't have the books. And my publisher told me, go ahead and tell them, you don't have the books are coming, but you don't turn down that money. And I did, so that made it, so that was exciting. And then, like I said, I've had great success with people reading my books. I hope more people will say, this man needs some help with, you know, no child support coming in, all the attorney's fees that I've spent, all the airline tickets. I hope they do support both of us because we need it. I'm not saying we're hurting, but, you know, times are tough right now, and I've gone through a lot, but I'm going to spread the word. Like I said, I'm going to make it. I'm not a preacher like my dad, but I am a preacher, but a preacher about, you know, being positive and all. And I hope I motivate other African Americans to go after your goals and dreams.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much, Abe. As we come down to just having like 2 minutes left to go, what last words of encouragement or advice would you like to leave with our listeners here at Off the Shelf, as we only have 2 minutes left in the show?
Well, I would say I want to be a good role model, but the most important thing to me is to be a good role model for my son, Justin. That's the most important thing for me, and I talk about that a lot. But sure, I want people to look at my life and say, if this man can go through what the court system and what his ex-wife did out, you know, doled out to him, I wasn't going to quit. You know, I told my ex-wife's attorney at one point, I wrote her a letter and I said, I'm going to be just like John Paul Jones. I have not yet begun to fight. I wasn't going to give up. But the bottom line is, Justin's here and I see him every single day. He's the love of my life. He's a great kid. I love him dearly. And I'm so glad that God blessed me with such a good child. So don't give up no matter what happens. Things will get better. That's what I want people to know and believe and have faith and trust and pray and on and on and on. But you can make it in this world.
Wow. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Abe Morris, the author of the books. Justin, I encourage you to get a copy of his book. You can learn more about the things that he experienced as he worked to get custody for his son, dealing with child support in the New Jersey court system, and some of the things he's still dealing with, even though he has had custody of his son since September of 2008. You can pick up a copy of Justin at Abe Morris's website, which is www.abemorris.com. And you can also get a copy of his book, My Cowboy Hat Still Fits, because he was involved in the rodeo as a broadcaster and as a rodeo writer for several years. So please stop in and visit Abe Morris online. Again, the author of the books, Justin and My Cowboy Hat Still Fits, www.abemorris.com. And please stop in and visit me online at Chistell, Chistell.com, and pick up a copy of my new book, Long Walk Up. Thank you so much for being here with us this Saturday. We'll be back, continue to bring you writers, editors, publishers, and other movers and shakers in the literary world every Saturday morning here at Off the Shelf Blog Talk Radio at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Before we close, as I always tell you, remember that you are so incredibly valued and loved and truly blessed. Thank you for being here with us. Remember to stop in and check out Abe Morris. Thank you, and bye for now. Abe, I'll shoot you an email.
Okay.